Youth Focus, a series of programs dealing with issues of concern to people ages 15 to 24. This week, Lynn Price and Jocelyn Sampson focus on legal rights of youth.
Prior to 1908, there existed no legal rights for young people separate from those of adults. The law was uniform for all ages. The Industrial Revolution and subsequent Child Savers Movement helped to change this. The Dickensian era saw an increase in the number of young paupers and orphanages. Youths were no longer viewed simply as a part of the family unit. Young people became visible as a class. The legal system reflected this change in social attitude. The Juvenile Delinquents Act of 1908 came in response to these 18th and 19th century changes and remained in place until 1984. The Paternalistic Act ruled that the child should be, quote, treated not as a criminal but as a misdirected, misguided child, one in need of aid, encouragement, help, and assistance. Under the JDA, a young person between the ages of 7 and an upper age determined by each individual province could be charged only with a delinquency. Delinquencies included any violation of the criminal code, federal or provincial statute, or municipal regulation. A status charge, such as truancy, which could not be committed by an adult, was adequate cause for the arrest of a young person. There existed no distinct laws for the sentencing of young people. Harbans Dillon, an administrative committee member of the BC Human Rights Coalition, Vancouver region, explains.
All you were found to be, if you were in contravention of any type of crime or any type of provincial legislation, you were found to be a delinquent. And so that could mean that you could be treated in the same manner if you stole a package of cigarettes as if you stabbed somebody. That was up to the court to impose the sentence. And now with the Young Offenders Act, the criminal code lays down for specific types of crimes what the sentence ought to be, and persons in youth court are bound to follow what the criminal code says, as are persons in adult court. And I think in that sense it's a much fairer system. You know exactly in black and white what the consequences of your actions are.
In April 1984, the Young Offenders Act replaced the Juvenile Delinquents Act, which had remained virtually unchanged since its 1908 implementation. As had been the case with the JDA, the YOA also reflected a change in society's attitude toward young people. The YOA covers federal crimes and alludes to the criminal code as to charges and sentencing. Under the JDA, youths who broke the law were seen as juvenile delinquents. Under the YOA, they are considered to be young offenders. The YOA is seen by most people as a compromise between the protection of society, the personal accountability of the youth, and also the protection of the young person. Ron Rappin is a research officer for Legal Information Services with the Legal Services Society. He believes that the philosophy that the JDA was based on was too simple and that its replacement was necessary.
The concept, of course, of the Juvenile Delinquents Act, too, was that the judge acted as a stern but fair parent. That seemed at the time to be a fairly simple matter. Again, our experience has shown, I think, quite clearly, that it's just not that easy. Do the interrelationships of social needs and the personal needs of the young person, where do they start and end?
Ian McKenzie is a corporal with the Vancouver Police Department and an instructor in legal services at the BC Police Academy.
The JDA was, over 75 years old when it was finally abolished. And it really had no rights for the young person. And even though society and the police and judges were, I think, honestly doing their best to protect the kids, there's a danger that while in good faith they're doing that, they're in fact trampling on kids' rights, and I think that that's not fair.
Graham Carr is the deputy director of the Willingdon Youth Detention Center. He believes that the JDA became outdated and that the new Young Offenders Act more clearly explains youth rights and responsibilities.
It's a matter of accountability and responsibility. I think young people are much more sophisticated than they were when the JDA came into force in 1908, and it's an act that was never really updated. Kids that are 14 and 15 now are much, much more sophisticated and much more aware of what goes on in the world. It's been my experience in the 6 or 7 years I've been here that the act we now have is the much more effective one. The kids appreciate it, they know where they stand, they know where their rights are, they know what's due to them, and they know what they have to do. It's pretty clear cut, positive for them and positive for us. The JDA was very, very fuzzy. We had a dual role. On the one hand, we were here to supervise and in fact guard them. On the other hand, we're here to be fathers and mothers to them. It doesn't work that way.
Another problem with the JDA was the lack of personal responsibility expected of young people and the lack of consideration given to the protection of society. Ron Rappin of the Legal Services Society.
Surprisingly enough, one of the problems with the Juvenile Delinquents Act was that no one ever looked at personal responsibility. There was a philosophy that was produced in the Juvenile Delinquents Act in many slightly different forms, but it all boiled down to the fact that the juvenile was to be treated as a misdirected or misguided child and one in need of aid and protection and direction. You'll notice that in that statement there is nothing about personal responsibility. We have, as a society, it would appear, now feel that no, there is some response, some ability or some responsibility to accept the reality of their own actions. Not necessarily the same as an adult would, but at least some degree. The other thing is protection of society. Again, if you look at the misguided, misdirected youth concept, there is nothing implicit in that to say that society should be protected from the dangerous juvenile. That's in the new act. It's actually the paramount concept, the paramount direction given to the judge. First of all, make sure that society is protected, then look at the needs of the young person.
But what rights do young people have, and which of these have been legislated by the YOA? Harbans Dillon of the BC Human Rights Coalition.
Well, I think young persons have the social rights or the welfare rights that we assume that every person in society has, the right to adequate food and adequate shelter and all of those rights. But those aren't rights that are written in law. Those are rights that we assume exist, and we assume that people will jump up to make sure that they're not being denied. In terms of political rights, young persons have no rights. They don't have the right to vote, so therefore they don't have any clout in the political arena. In terms of legal rights, they have some rights, but only under the Young Offenders Act. They don't have rights under law in any other area if they are under the age of majority, in the sense that, you know, they can't go out and buy a house or sign their name on the dotted line or do any of those other things that persons of sort of adult age or the age of majority could do. So essentially, I think what you're looking at it is a very narrow area of rights that have been legislated specifically for young persons in mind.
Ron Rappin of the Legal Services Society explains that with a few exceptions, such as the absolute right to counsel at the court level and the requirement for a written signature on a rights waiver agreement, youths under the YOA now share the same basic rights as adults.
The bottom line is that generally, as far as the process is concerned, the young person has the same rights as an adult. And that comes from two factors. The Act says that the Charter of Rights shall apply to young people, the same as they do to all adult Canadians. It also says that much of the process will be guided by the Criminal Code. And the Criminal Code, of course, has the normal legal protections for the adult offender. So by including that, it gives a pretty well basically equivalency to the adult situation.
Under the Young Offenders Act, youths have also gained rights such as the mandatory reading of rights, the right to due process, and the destruction of records under specific guidelines. Harbans Dillon.
I think the most fundamental right is that they're entitled now to have a lawyer represent them. The other, of course, is that along with that, they're entitled to what we call due process of law. That they're told that they have a right to remain silent, they're told that they have a right to have a lawyer, and they're dealt with in a judicial manner as are adults. That is, they're given sort of all of the protections that a state can give them. You have to remember that a criminal justice system is an adversarial system. It pits the individual against the state. The state accuses somebody of a crime. The state has Crown Counsel and police officers and others who provide the evidence of the crime that has been alleged. And then a young person essentially has to then try and find a way of establishing, hopefully, some innocence. We do say, of course, that a person is innocent until proven guilty, but if the proof or those who provide the proof are so well versed, then a young person also requires some sort of balancing factor, and hopefully the Act does provide that balancing factor for them through lawyers, through due process, through persons who will question the adequacy of the proof, for instance, that the state might place before a judge.
The rights that the YOA extends to young people and the philosophy behind YOA legislation will fail to have an impact in practice unless the people working in the field support the philosophy and follow it up through practical implementation. Otherwise, the progressive elements of the Act may be lost. Harbans Dillon.
If the Young Offenders Act lays down a philosophy that says we want young persons to be fully protected and we want to ensure that they are accountable for their actions, if that philosophy isn't shared by police officers or probation officers or the judges, and their philosophy still lies somewhere where punishment is more important than helping a young person cope through whatever problem that he or she might be facing, then the Act itself is of little help.
It is as yet too early to know the impact that the YOA will have in the practical arena. But how do the people who are working with young offenders feel about the Act so far? Ian McKenzie, Vancouver Police Department.
In my initial training of police officers, the general feeling was negative. But I think it's inherent in policemen that they sometimes are negative about most changes. Over the past year, the general feeling is probably a little bit more positive, but still generally negative. Probably the concern is that there is too much concern with the rights of the young offender and not enough concern with the rights of the victim, which is true not just in the Young Offenders Act, but that's the view of policemen and a lot of society in all of criminal law. So there's that feeling that while we're protecting these kids from state intervention and police misconduct, what are we doing to protect the victims of their acts? And that's a frustration that policemen find in the Young Offenders Act, and as I say, in all criminal law as it stands right now.
Harbans Dillon of the BC Human Rights Coalition believes that there may be another reason for police opposition to the YOA.
Under the Juvenile Delinquents Act, they might have had a great deal of latitude and certainly a great deal of discretion in deciding whether to pick up a kid or not. And now under the Young Offenders Act, they have to be much more discerning. They have to decide whether what they have before them is something that they can take to a Crown Counsel to say that charges ought to be laid, that there has to be a crime that you can charge somebody with. And if now all of a sudden they're having to adhere to higher standards, not higher standards in terms of the adult criminal justice system, but higher than what they had to deal with under the Juvenile Delinquents Act, but at the same level as with adults, what we're now seeing then perhaps is a decline in the number of young persons who are processed through the youth justice system. And if that's what the reason might be, and I think it's as plausible as any other explanation, then what we are having is a tacit admission by the police that perhaps their prior pickup procedures might have been too loose, that they were just rounding up kids that looked like they were out for a good time.
By people working in corrections, the Act has been welcomed. Graham Carr of the Willingdon Youth Detention Center.
I think the staff are much more appreciative of the YOA. Again, it's very much more clear-cut for them. One of the problems they're having of late is that our physical plant is really pretty outdated, needs a lot of upgrading. So we've been under construction for a number of months, and it's been pretty frustrating for the staff. So they haven't seen the impact that the positive impact that the Act can have on them. It's now starting to come together, and they're starting to be much more familiar with it, much more happy with it.
While police may be generally reluctant to embrace the Act, Ian McKenzie admits it has helped police in some ways.
The YOA states in the statute itself that we can fingerprint people. That's a benefit for investigative purposes. Another benefit for the police is the fact that the YOA has removed the jurisdiction for provincial offenses. From from the federal sphere. And the result is that for Motor Vehicle Act offenses, most specifically, it's much easier for a police officer now dealing with a 16-year-old, for example, to give a ticket for speeding. Under the old Juvenile Delinquents Act, he had to go through a vast amount of paperwork because speeding was actually a Juvenile Delinquent Act offense. So it's extremely beneficial for the enforcement of provincial statutes, and it's also helpful for fingerprinting. Those are two specific examples.
Along with the areas in which the YOA has helped people who deal with young offenders, it has also introduced more red tape and bureaucracy. We asked Graham Carr how he felt about the increased paperwork.
It's a pain. No question about that. The largest pain for us is going to have to be the destruction of records or provisions under the YOA. We must destroy files. So yes, it's a gigantic pain.
Increased paperwork has also been a problem for police. In fact, in the months after the YOA was implemented, charges laid against youths dropped 50%. Many officers report that this was because of the paperwork now involved in charging a youth with an offense.
There was a drop in charges. Talked to police officers and asked them why, and they just say minor offenses. It's easier to take the kid home or to just tell the kid to go home. That it's not worth the paperwork. I personally don't agree with that. I don't think they're doing their job if that's their view. If in fact there is more paperwork, then their administration has to get some help for the police officer in the street.
The YOA also outlines that records of young offenders must be destroyed under certain time guidelines. Ian McKenzie explains that this too has served to increase the bureaucracy of the police department.
But I think the major concern with the police is that it's just such an astronomical amount of work involved in keeping bring forward dates and actually destroying records. A police investigation results in a lot of records. It results in fingerprints, it results in an investigation report, and if there's a charge, it results in a Crown Council report. It might result in insurance file being started with letters on the police file from an insurance company if it's a property offense. All these things create paper, and they all have to be destroyed at certain particular times under the statute. So it creates a bureaucracy that perhaps police forces can't afford given the lack of public funds.
There are also more philosophical guidelines within the YOA with which people working in the area disagree. The age limits of the JDA were between 7 and an upper age which was determined by provincial legislation. In BC, the YOA applied to those under 17. Under Section 15 of the new Charter of Rights, discrimination on the basis of age is illegal, and so the YOA established a nationally uniform age of 18. The lower age limit was raised from 7 to 12. Graham Carr comments on the raising of the maximum age.
I think it's unnecessary. I think it wasn't a good move. I think uniform age across the country is important. 18 is just too old. I think they're adults, they're sophisticated adults, and I think it's probably wrong to mix those.
The reading of rights to a young person upon arrest is also a new legal right under the YOA. While police don't mind this statute too much, they are in general opposition to the new stipulations regarding the taking of statements.
I don't think they have that many concerns with reading somebody their right to counsel. I think the concern is more the extended rights under Section 56 when police officers are taking statements. And that is just such a complicated list of rights that you have to tell this young offender, and you have to tell the young offender in words that are that he is capable of understanding, that it makes every case reviewable. And while the police officer might have done everything in good faith, the statute is so specific that he may have missed out something. And then a statement which is in fact voluntary and truthful will still not be admissible. And I think police officers find that frustrating, that why set up all these artificial statutory roadblocks? Why not just go under the old rule, which is if a statement is voluntary, that is the statement truthful, then it's admissible.
Is the YOA generally frustrating to work under, especially for police? Ian McKenzie.
I think certainly the taking of statements is frustrating. The courts so far have not been very uniform in their interpretation of Section 56. There have been a few statement forms found to be inappropriate by the courts, and it's frustrating not to know from one day to another whether or not a statement that the police officer takes in good faith is in fact going to be technically admissible in a court because of these specific statutory rules. So the taking of statements is definitely frustrating. I think also the frustration of dealing with somebody maybe the age of your son telling you he has all these rights and you better respect them, otherwise you're the one in trouble, not him. That's humanly frustrating for anybody. So those two things are frustrating. Again, it's new, and there's a certain frustration in implementing anything new.
The public has also had a few words to say about the YOA. This response has often been negative. Ron Rappin.
I think that much of the response falls into two categories. The human resistance to change. If one has been doing a job in a certain way and viewing the world from a certain point of view, it's difficult for us to change. And we have a tendency to be overcritical of anything that forces us to change. So I think that that is something of a factor. I think also it was unfortunate the negotiations between the provincial and federal government over cost sharing was in the press for such a long period of time, and the quotations and so many of the phrases that were used in those press releases had a tendency to look as if the one level of government was saying that the act was all bad. And there were many negative sort of connotations that the general public picked up from those.
Has the extension of legal rights to youths affected the attitudes of young people? Ian McKenzie.
What I've heard from the officers on the street is that there is a certain cockiness about the young offenders they pick up now, and they do know their rights. Whether that is factual or whether it's just what the police officer feels, because the young offender is, in fact, he has the gall, basically, to ask for his rights. And when you're dealing with your 40-year-old police officer with a 10-year-old son or a 15-year-old son, and you've got a 17-year-old or a 15-year-old kid basically telling you you can't do anything to him until he gets his rights, it's human nature to be a little bit resentful of that. So the police officer may be looking at it with a little bit jaundiced eyes in that sense. But what I hear back from the street is that there is a cockiness about the young offenders that they're picking up now, as opposed to the juvenile delinquents they picked up prior to the Young Offenders Act.
A common criticism of the YOA, and often of the judicial system in general, is that offenders get off too easily. Ian McKenzie believes that police are generally of the mind that young offenders do get off too easily. This problem may not, however, be the result of legislation, but rather the outcome of poor implementation of the YOA.
The statute, the Young Offenders Act, has several dispositions available to the judge, some of them which can be quite onerous, more onerous than under the Juvenile Delinquents Act. The custody provisions, I don't think, personally, and I think most police officers would agree, the custody provisions are not onerous enough for very serious offenses. The other dispositions, things like probation, community services, I think that they are, in the statute at least, severe enough, but the judges, and with respect that I'm saying this, the judges, I don't think, are applying the law strictly enough, with the result that some of these kids think it's a mockery that they get charged and go through the system, and that can be a little bit stigmatizing, but nothing comes from it at the end. And it gives them a false sense of security, I think, when they especially enter into the adult area and they start getting hit with a few harder sentences. So it's unfair to the kids as well as, I think, unfair to society.
Harbans Dillon disagrees.
Well, I think there is a fallacy in that argument that assumes that somehow punishment equals deterrence. I don't think you can say that punishing somebody strictly is going to lead to their rehabilitation. In fact, one of the reasons why we have a youth justice system which is separated from an adult justice system is that young persons are at an impressionable age and that they do things sometimes without thinking about the consequences. And the benefit of the doubt is probably better placed at this young age range than to worry about sort of throwing somebody into an adult criminal justice system where they do become hardened. I know for a fact that during the late 1800s, the whole idea of young persons being kept away from adult criminals was because they didn't want young persons to become hardcore criminals. And now we're talking about punishing young persons. Fine, does that mean that you punish them by placing them into institutions where there are other young persons who are hardcore criminals, essentially? Or do you just hope that they learn from the experience? The thing to remember also, of course, is that persons within the youth justice system are experienced persons. They have seen a whole range of young persons with a variety of crimes or alleged crimes come before them. And I think that they're probably the most capable persons in terms of deciding what kinds of remedies ought to be imposed for a young person.
Arbenz also believes that people often don't consider all the important aspects that surround a case when criticizing a judge's disposition or sentence.
I think when people say young kids get off easier, it's an impressionistic viewpoint. I don't even know whether you could quantify that. That is, does a young person who's accused of stealing something under $200, is he or she treated less harshly than an adult who's accused of stealing under $200? What are the other factors in place? Does a young person have a previous criminal conviction of any kind? Does the adult? So once those factors are accounted for, maybe then we can say, yes, the system does treat young persons less harshly than adults, but then we have to look at what the social factors are, whether we want to treat young persons less harshly so that, in fact, they do reform.
Ron Rappin believes that while the Act provides leeway for letting first offenders off without stiff penalty, it also provides for an appropriate stiffening of dispositions when and if youths persist with their criminal careers.
This is not a piece of mollycoddling legislation to try and make things easy for the young person. No. Rather the reverse. The intention of this Act, as I see it, is to make sure that they are aware that they're responsible to society. And the fact that we're not going to necessarily hang them or lock them up for life because of their age doesn't mean that they can't accept that responsibility. And it's part of what's viewed as possibly the improving sophistication of our young people. I'm not sure that that's really true for the purposes of this Act. But the point is that this Act is responding to the needs of society, that the protections for the young person are in fact just the other side of the coin, our natural sense of fairness. But what we got into the pond to do was to try and make sure that society is protected.
Despite the media coverage of the YOA in the past few years, do youths even know that the Act exists? Do they know what their rights are? Ian McKenzie.
I think that the young people who are constantly breaking the law are certainly aware of their rights. As far as the average young person or kid, just like the average adult, I think he is aware that he has that there are some new rights out there. But I don't think he's aware of his specific rights, really, to tell you the truth. And that's probably why the YOA does place a positive responsibility on the police officer to advise him of those rights, which is fair. I think any fair-minded police officer would admit that.
Harbenz Dillon.
That's a real problem, because I know certainly from the Human Rights Coalition's perspective, we know, for a matter of fact, that when young persons don't know of their rights, they won't know when those rights have been violated. I mean, it's almost one goes hand in hand with the other. And so if you don't know that you're entitled to a lawyer and you are brought into a criminal justice system and you are totally ignorant of that right, you're going to give up rights as a consequence without even knowing. And so what we need to do now is to focus on providing some legal rights, human rights education to young persons. The Act certainly doesn't provide for that, and so we have to look to government and to community groups and to schools to make sure that young persons know what their rights are.
Graham Carr believes that while youths may not know their rights now, the knowledge isn't long in coming.
The more sophisticated ones, of course, learn pretty quickly. We're still in a transitional time. Another year or two, I think most kids will have it figured out. They're pretty smart.
We asked Ron Rappin if he thinks youths know their rights, and if they do they understand the philosophy behind them?
No, and that's extremely difficult to get across, because some of the concepts are quite deep, quite philosophical. I sometimes find that people in the system don't have a clear idea of what the true meaning of some of these things. So it's very difficult to get across without being glib. I, along with anyone else, would not want to go into the position of simply saying, lie. You know, that is not the intention of the right to remain silent. That's the problem. So trying to get a young person to understand his legal protections and have them in balance with society's needs is very difficult.
Harbans Dhillon urges this to young people.
I think young persons have to take on some of the responsibility for themselves in fighting for their rights, that rights are never given to you, that you have to fight for them and that you have to demand them. Because if rights were given automatically, they wouldn't be as precious as we deem them to be. And I see some complacency and some kind of laid back feeling in young persons that somehow the only thing that they have to worry about is leading the proper consumer oriented lifestyle. They don't seem to realize how important their rights are to them.
If you don't know what your legal rights as a young person are, or if you suspect that your rights are being infringed upon, you can call the information line of the Legal Services Society at 660-4673. For Youth Focus, I'm Jocelyn Sampson.
And I'm Lynn Price.
Youth Focus was produced in the studios of CITR-FM and was made possible by a grant from the Canadian government.